Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the first program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation tonight is about states' rights then and now. For much of our nation's history, invoking the words states' rights has meant opposing the federal government's efforts to abolish slavery and enforce racial desegregation, while at the same time supporting laws that discriminate at the state level against various ethnic, religious, or other minority groups. But there's more to this history of states' rights than that, and there's a growing movement to invoke states' rights now to defend a progressive agenda in the years ahead from the threat of a potentially hostile federal government. This show was pre-recorded on January 14th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Jessica Bullman-Posen is the Betts Professor of Law and Faculty Co-Director of the Center for Constitutional Governance at Columbia Law School. Welcome, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Curran-Rowles is the Executive Director of the ACLU of Maine. Welcome, Molly.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And Lucy Hochschartner. Lucy is the Climate and Clean Energy Director for Maine Conservation Voters. We're pleased to have you as well, Lucy.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's get started. I think the beginning of the show, we're going to put a lot of weight on Jessica's shoulders and ask her to explain sort of the constitutional and historical background. I guess our first question is, like, what does the Constitution say about states' rights versus the federal government, and why did they do it that way?
Yes, that's a big question. I think the Constitution, on the one hand, says a lot about this, but in other respects, says almost nothing about it. We don't have, for example, a clause that clearly lays out the allocation of power between the states and the federal government in the way that question might suggest. What we have is an array of constitutional provisions that were there from the founding that enumerate the powers of the federal government. We also have the 10th Amendment that's there from shortly after the initial Constitution that says if a power hasn't been given to the federal government, then it remains with the state or the people. And the sort of enigmatic character of that amendment has led to a lot of debates over time about the balance between states and the federal government. And then we have watershed moments, most importantly, Reconstruction and the amendments that follow the Civil War that really radically alter the relationship between the states and the federal government and provide a different balance of power, different relationships between the states and their people and the federal government and their people. So there's really quite a lot to unpack there. And I'm happy to talk more about the founding design or the changes over time as we go about the conversation.
Just to say a little bit more about the 10th Amendment and the Reconstruction Amendments. And as you said, they changed the relationship. How did the Reconstruction Amendments change what was originally set up?
Yeah, so the founding constitution, the constitution of the 18th century, sets up a system in which the national government has powers that are new and that are important powers beyond what the Articles of Confederation had provided. But the understanding is that all federal power must be enumerated. The federal government doesn't have the authority to act unless the power is laid out in the constitution. So one change that happens over time is that some powers that were laid out in the Constitution, like the Commerce Clause, the commerce power, which didn't do as much at the founding, come to carry quite a lot of weight with respect to federal authority. And the 10th Amendment does nothing to limit that. But at the same time as the federal government obtains these powers in the 18th century, the states are really the site of most regulation, most activity, because we don't have an interconnected economy the way we do now. We don't have the federal government attempting to do as much regulation as happens over time. Also critical, we have federal constitutional rights, first enumerated in the Bill of Rights, that only apply against the federal government. They're rights that individuals hold against the federal government, but not against the states. And so one of the really important things that changes in Reconstruction with the 14th Amendment is for the first time at the end of the 19th century, after the Civil War, federal constitutional rights are understood gradually to start to apply against the states as well as against the federal government. So people now possess, when we talk about their First Amendment rights or their Fourth Amendment rights, These rights come to be incorporated through the 14th Amendment against the states as well as against the federal government. So one important change with the Reconstruction Amendments is that people have federal rights against the states, beginning with the 14th Amendment itself, and then carried forward to other rights. And the Reconstruction period also marks an idea that the federal government may be a protector of people against their own states in a way that was not really on the radar of the founders. And so the federal government, Congress in particular, through its 14th Amendment powers, will have the authority to be enforcing rights of people against their states. Those, I think, are the two really significant changes that happened.
I see Molly nodding. I don't know if you want to drop in here, Molly.
I'm remembering great things from law school and just revisiting this material. Well, it's fantastic.
Well, I mean, I'm hearing you say that, Jessica, like being not a lawyer and being, you know, not immersed in this, I'm hearing you say that, like in the beginning with the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech was protected. The federal government could not clamp down on my freedom of speech, but my state could if they wanted to, until after Reconstruction, at which time freedom of speech was understood to be a freedom that neither the federal nor the state government could impinge upon.
Yes. So I elided over some things. It takes a little while longer to get to that point, because what happens is basically that the 14th Amendment provides the vehicle through which the Supreme Court, what we call, incorporates the Bill of Rights against the state. So that doesn't actually happen until the early 20th century. It doesn't happen immediately with the 14th Amendment. But yes, the 14th Amendment creates the conditions under which federal constitutional rights come to also be rights that people enjoy against the states, as well as the federal government. So that change in rights, as well as the change in powers, is very important. But I will also just note, state constitutions have always existed. Some of them predated the federal constitution. And so individuals have rights that are quite important under their state constitutions. And they had those against the states prior to the incorporation of federal constitutional rights.
And when we talk about this, I think people maybe don't understand what the word federalism means in relationship to states' rights. Like, federalism does not necessarily mean a strong federal government, does it?
Federalism usually means the division of power between states and the national government, so that both governments have certain authorities and direct relationships to the people themselves. People use words like federalism in many different ways, and so often it's hard to nail down one particular definition. But yes, there's we call it the federal government. Sometimes we should call it the national government, maybe to distinguish between these arrangements of federalism. But one of the sort of innovative features of American federalism in the 18th century that has stayed with us all of these centuries is the idea that we have shared sovereignty between the states and the federal government. The federal government is the more powerful of the two, and it can displace contrary state action in a way that the states do not have the power to do in reverse. But we do have very critical powers lodged with both the states and the federal government.
Federalism kind of goes back to the root, where, I don't know which is the root here, but federalism means a federation, which gives emphasis to the fact that the states are entities that are powerful, right?
Yeah, the states have their own sovereign authorities, their own government authorities. They have their own direct relationships with their people, and they possess very important prerogatives. I think that's absolutely right. There's a lot of overlap in what the states and the federal government do. And so some of the ways that the states are empowered don't look like what people used to call dual federalism, where the federal government did some things and states did different things. We actually have a system with quite a bit of integration overlap. But even when you have that, the states retain very important powers in, for example, administering federal programs, carrying out federal laws, or choosing not to, and regulating in many of the same domains that the federal government does. So I think we have not really sort of separate states in the federal government so much as integrated and overlapping governments, but that's to take nothing away from the state's role in that.
What is the thing that Texas has been trying to do that has to do with, is it a refusal of the state to enforce federal law? There's a name for that, right?
Nullification.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I mean, so some of the, you know, key words in sort of states' rights discourse are nullification and secession, I would say. You know, so nullification referring to the idea, which is discredited, that the states can just by disagreeing with federal law, effectively nullify or render it inoperative. States don't have that power, but states do have a very important power, which is to refuse to cooperate with the federal government. And this is based mostly on a doctrine that comes out of the 10th Amendment, as we were discussing, the anti-commandeering doctrine, which says basically that the federal government can't give orders to the states, can't make them cooperate in carrying out regulatory objectives of the federal government, can't make them pass laws that the federal government would like them to pass. So sometimes that means the federal government can still do something itself, but it places a limit on the federal government's use of state capacity and state powers. So even if states can't nullify per se, states can often be quite effective in putting up resistance to the federal government by saying, we don't want to cooperate, we don't want to participate in that program. And because they have a right to refuse, a right to reject that federal government approach, then that can really hinder the federal government's efforts, given how vast state capacity is in many areas compared to federal government capacity.
I don't want to dive too deep into this right now, but Molly, I want to maybe ask you to just talk about an example of what we were just saying, this nullification and commandeering in the context of immigration, because I think that's where we hear these concepts thrown around the most.
That's right. And the ACLU has done a lot of work in the run-up to the Trump administration to think about the areas that we believe are most likely to be really critical for folks to be ready to push back on federal power and on certain policies where we can. There's a lot of detailed information about that on our website. There are, I think, 15 different memos that articulate different elements of what we anticipate. But one of the big areas, especially in Maine, is related to immigration. You know, looking at the opportunities that the state has to articulate its own prerogatives, especially in terms of law enforcement, and to say the resources that we have locally need to be used to effectuate Maine-based law enforcement objectives and not used to just run roughshod over Maine people because of other obligations that are being articulated by the federal government. That's been a really important piece that we've been looking to both empower the state at the state level to think about and also talking to local folks about as well, in particular jurisdictions.
So trying to put it in the terms that Jessica was introducing, Maine can't nullify federal law in terms of immigration. The federal law is the federal law, but at the same time, the federal government cannot commandeer Maine resources to enforce federal law. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right. I mean, there are ways that the federal government can put pressure on states. One common way is through funding mechanisms, right, to try to convince states that it's in their best interest to work collaboratively with the federal government. Immigration is interesting because it is an area that is where the power to make law and to be responsible for this area is really held at the federal level. So it's one of the areas like national security also where we see, you know, there are tensions here, and it's not an area where, for example, the state constitution could do a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a quick station break, and then I want to come back and talk a little bit about the history of the 10th Amendment and the way it's been used and played out historically. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is states' rights, then and now. Our guests this afternoon are Molly Curran-Rowles, Executive Director of the ACLU of Maine, Lucy Hochschartner, Climate and Clean Energy Director for Maine Conservation Voters, and Jessica Bullman-Posen, the Betts Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. This program was pre-recorded on January 14th. No listener calls are being taken now. So Jessica, recapitulate for us a little bit. I said in my introduction, when people hear states' rights, they basically think voter suppression, racist voter suppression, frankly, and they think about this having its roots in the Civil War when people use the word states' rights to mean protecting slavery. That's not the whole story, but that's part of the story. Give us like the 10-minute version of American history on states' rights. You're probably teaching a whole semester on this, but go ahead, do what you can.
Yeah, so a quick snapshot. I mean, I think it's absolutely correct that the specific language of states' rights has a very sordid history and is strongly associated with attempts to preserve slavery, attempts to preserve racial segregation and oppression. And it's hard to shake that association. But the history of states trying to act in opposition to federal power or states trying to chart a different course that is in some sense oppositional is much more varied and has, I think, many things to say for it, as well as certainly things to be very concerned about. So even with respect to an example like slavery, the states' rights language is very associated with state attempts to preserve slavery at all costs against any federal attempt to end the slave trade and to stop the practice of enslavement. But in the middle of the 19th century, at the same time as we had Southern states seeking to invoke state rights to defend the practice, you had Northern states in which the abolitionist movement was quite successful in passing state laws that would defy the federal fugitive slave acts and attempts to enforce those. The U.S. Supreme Court held such laws unconstitutional, but there were state efforts by abolitionist groups in particular that found a real foothold in the states in a way they couldn't in the federal government. So even with an issue like slavery, you had the states on both sides, you had political organizing that was successful in the states in attempting to stop as well as attempting to continue slavery. And that's been true basically throughout the course of American history, where you have some states invoking states' rights against the federal government to do something that might feel, well, just use today's vernacular, right? So conservative, and others doing something liberal. And because we have now 50 states, of course, fewer over the course of history, you have very different positions in the states over time. But you have not only this sort of opposition to the federal government, you also, when you think about what states have done over the course of American history, the idea of states' rights is often associated with an idea of checking the federal government, resisting the federal government. That's a very important batch of state activity. But there's also a strain of federalism thought that focuses on states, in the words of Justice Brandeis, as laboratories of experimentation, an idea that states will innovate, states will try out new policies, states will try to push things forward. So much of the more progressive reform we've had in this country over the centuries has come from efforts that were only able to take root in the states and then only then made it up to the federal level. So that's true with respect to labor laws and environmental laws. It's true with respect to women getting the right to vote. It's true with respect to a whole host of issues. It wasn't necessarily that the states were saying states' rights, but that social movements, political actors, and others were saying, maybe we can succeed in this smaller jurisdiction, succeed in this one particular pocket, and then this will spread, and then we will succeed perhaps at a national level. So I think the simplest thing to say about the history of states' rights is that even though that particular term is very much associated with a certain kind of state activity, the actions of states in opposition to the federal government and in innovating on their own are always complicated and always quite diverse.
And since you mentioned states' rights in the context of environmental action, maybe I'll give Lucy a chance to chime in and see if she's got an example just off the top of her head where states have advanced environmental conservation way in advance of the federal government.
Definitely. There are numerous examples of states passing laws that really lead on environmental issues. And I think, you know, in the Maine context, we're leading every day. We don't have a federal climate plan the same way that we have a Maine climate action plan. And I think we saw in the last Trump administration that states really took a lead role. And I think we're going to see that again. We're certainly working at Maine Conservation Voters to think about all of the ways we can continue to advance priorities under a federal administration that may not be. I think it is important to note that particularly with environmental issues and climate issues more broadly, lots of priorities are complex, but the environment is uniquely a systems level problem. And so the plans of the incoming administration are incompatible with the kind of future we want to see at MCV. And at the same time, every little bit we can do helps. And just because we are not going to see that we are meeting all of the goals that we need to avoid the worst possible case scenario, every single bit of reduced emissions, every single bit of land conserved, every, you know, pollutant taken out of the water does matter, and it all makes it better. And so those are the things that we are going to be working on in the coming years. And in terms of states' rights more broadly. I think the most famous example, the most famous environmental preemption that states do is probably California has the unique ability to preempt the federal government with regards to air pollution standards for cars. And so you see that many states actually end up adopting California standards rather than the federal government standards to make sure that we're lowering emissions.
And I mean, that's just because of the size of their economy, right? Like an action that they take has a huge impact.
Yeah, California definitely is working with, they have a lot more pieces on the board than we do in Maine. And so the actions they take matter. But I think we also see in Maine, and, you know, of course, the League of Women Voters know this because you do so much work on democracy issues. Maine has really been a trendsetter in the past. And so even when our actions may not affect as large of an emissions pool as California or anything like that, showing up and being a leader really can impact other states because states look to each other for policy and governors talk to other governors and state legislators talk to other state legislators. And, you know, regardless, certainly on our conservation priorities, those we want to make sure that we're having the clean air and clean water we need for people right here in Maine. But even beyond that, we can have an effect that I think is much, much larger than our 1 million people would suggest.
There you go. Thought leaders, if you will. So before we turn to Project 2025 and, you know, the plans of the incoming administration, I just want to give you a chance, Jessica, to reflect on how the Roberts Court has related to states' rights in the last, how long has it been, 20 years?
Well, I think in some ways, the most important set of doctrines with respect to federalism and the Roberts Court, I think there's a number of things that can be said, but relate to this idea of commandeering that I was mentioning a little bit before, the idea that the federal government can't give command to the states to force them to regulate in certain ways. Because one, even though that doctrine predated the Roberts Court, it was first announced in the 1990s. So it's not that old, but as such, it was first announced in the 1990s. It was extended a little bit in a case called Murphy in 2018 under the Roberts Court in ways that I think have implications, especially for sanctuary cities, as we were discussing a moment ago, for other important issues, the legalization of marijuana, abortion, other kinds of issues that are going to be the focus and have been the focus of state federal contestation. And also, Molly was mentioning the use of funds, federal government funds, to get the states to go along, even if the federal government can't give them orders. And that's a really important tool in the federal government's arsenal. But another thing that the Roberts Court said, and this was in the challenge to the Affordable Care Act, the NFIB versus Sebelius case, with respect to the Medicaid expansion, the court basically incorporated the anti-commandeering principles into its spending clause doctrine and said some kinds of offers of funding may themselves be coercive. Now, the court hasn't expanded on that. That might be just a one-off case, the way some other examples from Roberts Court have proven to be. But it does suggest that there are limits on the way the federal government might be using funds to coerce the states, as well as giving them orders. And that kind of idea also was important in the first Trump administration with respect to sanctuary cities and efforts to get around the anti-commandeering principle by tying grants, by tying funds to state assistance with federal immigration enforcement. And several lower courts said these funding claims that the federal executive branch is making are invalid. States do not have to cooperate to get the money in the way that the federal government and specifically the Trump administration is arguing. So I think there are a lot of other features of the Roberts Court federalism jurisprudence, including the Shelby County case, decimating the Voting Rights Act, a lot of others as well. But with respect to looking ahead, I would focus, I think, on the commandeering principle and how it's been expanded.
Well, you just make me want to answer those questions. So, like, what about Shelby? Was that friendly to states' rights or was that counter to states' rights? Or, I mean, we sort of think about the abortion ruling as giving these decisions back to the states and overturning federal authority in protecting women's reproductive rights. Does this all sort of flow one way or?
Well, I think people would perhaps describe Shelby County as a state's rights decision in the sort of pejorative sense that we were talking about before, certainly with respect to its undermining of the Federal Voting Rights Act. I think It's a good example of the Supreme Court not attending to the lessons of Reconstruction, because that's a case in which the court cites the 10th Amendment very heavily without recognizing the intervening 14th and 15th Amendments and the way in which they reshaped the relationship between voters and the states, voters and the federal government. So it may be a states' rights decision in certain respects. I think it's incorrect. With respect to a case like Dobbs, I think it's also true that in overturning the federal constitutional protections for abortion, there's language in the opinion and in the concurrence by Justice Kavanaugh suggesting all we're doing is giving this back to the states, so now everything will be fine. And of course, that's not the case. What we see, in addition to the undermining of people's right to have an abortion, is state-to-state conflict, a lot of interstate complication and challenge, and not some kind of simple solution where the people can just decide what laws they wish to have.
Yeah. And so would you say that the Roberts Court has been consistently in favor of weakening federal power and leaving states to make these decisions on their own in a patchwork decision? Or is that like a way oversimplification?
I think that's probably an oversimplification. Like, and it's not just the Roberts Court. I mean, it's people with federalism generally. I think there's, generally speaking, a more sort of instrumental relationship to federalism where there isn't a favoring of states or the federal government per se, but rather a favoring of certain kinds of substantive policies and substantive issues that then gets played out through state and federal power. And I think it's actually not a bad thing as a sort of matter of our national political culture that we have states and the federal government giving us a venue for that. But it does lead to, I think, some inconsistency.
Yeah. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Lucy Hochschartner, Climate and Clean Energy Director at Maine Conservation Voters, Jessica Bullman-Posen, Betts Professor of Law at Columbia Law School, and Molly Curran-Rawls, Executive Director of the ACLU of Maine. Our topic today is states' rights, then and now. This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. So we have the incoming Trump administration, and I'd like you each to reflect for a moment on what you expect from the Trump administration in terms of dismantling federal government agencies or protections and sending some of these questions back to the states. And why don't you start, Jessica? But I know both Molly and Lucy have thoughts on this in their respective areas.
Maybe just then at a high level of generality, I'll say I don't expect to see devolving power to the states generally and sort of removing federal government authority. I think, as we've already seen foreshadowed by the so-called attack on the administrative state, by the plans of Project 2025 and others, there's really a bifurcated approach where some federal agencies and some federal powers, and so there are things that Molly and Lucy especially can tell us more about, but policies with respect to regulating for a clean environment, regulating for health and safety, regulating for labor, are going to be seriously threatened. That's already been started with a series of judicial decisions, but it will now be on steroids with respect to the Trump administration. But I don't think it's right to equate that with removing federal power generally or limiting federal power generally and sending power back to the states, because at the same time as we see that challenge to regulation, a challenge to regulatory capacity, we see an effort to really seriously beef up the role and the powers of groups like ICE, groups within sort of the military contractor world, certain kinds of policing agencies and intelligence agencies. So there's an effort really to enhance the powers of some parts of the federal government at the expense of others. And through it all, I think states will likewise find a friendly federal government when they want to be on board with that agenda. And when they don't, they'll find a very hostile federal executive. Mm-hmm.
Lucy, let me ask you to sort of characterize how you and Maine Conservation Voters are looking at sort of states' rights, federal protections, and the incoming Trump administration. Just take a couple minutes on that.
Yeah, thanks so much, Anne. What a large topic, and it's something that I'm thinking about every day. I think to start, I'd just say I am the Climate and Clean Energy Director with Maine Conservation Voters. And so what I do on a day-to-day basis is try and ensure we have the laws in Maine that are going to allow us to have a future where nature and people are thriving together. And we're doing that with justice. We're doing that with equity. We're really concerned with making sure we have a just transition to clean energy. More broadly, our organization does also work on conservation issues. And I think those things are handled a little differently by the federal administration, the energy pieces and the conservation pieces, neither to our benefit. And then I think what's also important to know is...
Well, no, just hold on that thought and say, when you use that little shorthand, neither to our benefit, for our readers, what do you, yeah. for our listeners, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I think on the energy pieces, there's really a lot of our energy policy right now, particularly the energy policy that is supporting the build out of clean energy. So when we're talking about a transition, we're talking about both slowing down the use of fossil fuels and moving away from that and increasing the use of clean energy. And it's not just like an on-off switch. So both those things can happen at the same time, that we could be increasing clean energy and increasing dirty energy if we're just using more energy. So they are two separate pieces. And there's a lot of nuance, but broadly our policy to support clean energy happened through the Inflation Reduction Act. And so that was an act of Congress, and we'll take an act of Congress to roll back a lot of those pieces. That may happen. There's, you know, Republican control in all the branches, but that is going to be something that will have to be looked at in Congress. We've also heard from the incoming administration, you know, a real zeal for increasing the use of oil and gas. A lot of that can happen through executive action, permitting more projects or rolling back permitting some of the permitting rules that have helped environmental organizations stop problematic projects from happening. And then on the conservation side, that is very focused with executive action. And so we saw this last Trump administration as well, that is something there is a lot of leeway for the federal government to roll back protections for federal public land. I would say that's less of a concern specifically for Maine conservation voters, because we don't have a ton of federally conserved land in Maine. We're certainly worried about it. There are some national monuments and things like that. But broadly, when the environmental group is thinking about conservation under the Trump administration and these federal lands, we're thinking about large swaths of land out west where protections could sort of be rolled back with, you know, the signing of just a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by those differences there.
It seems like a lot of Project 2025 is sort of dismantling the bureaucracy, right? The agencies. And as it relates to your work, Lucy, it seems like maybe the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency would be the ones where, if they were dismantled, it would leave a bureaucratic vacuum. What are you thinking about that?
Definitely. And so I think this gets to the point that, and I think Molly may be in a similar position. So I work at Maine Conservation Voters. We also have a federal partner, the League of Conservation Voters, that does take a lot of this federal work. So not going to pretend to be the total expert on every piece here, but we certainly are worried about these rollbacks. I would say specifically in my work in Maine, I see like four things being at risk with the Trump administration, one of which is that rollbacks and lessening of the administrative state. One of them is the staffing of who's actually going to be in those positions. But what I work on a lot is actually what kinds of things will be able to get permitted. So a lot of the work I do is on offshore wind. They've signaled pretty clearly with the federal administration a desire to stop permitting those projects. And then the funding as well. Maine has received an incredible amount of funding from the Biden administration to pay for the clean energy transition and invest in communities. And so even if these agencies aren't totally rolled back, just without having the funding, it's really going to slow down the transition. So I do worry about the rollbacks, but I think for Maine specifically, because we have such strong bedrock laws here, what I worry about more is that lack of funding that's going to be coming to ensure that we can really make clean energy on a level playing field with fossil fuels that are heavily subsidized. And we at Maine Conservation Voters are always thinking about how the question has become, it's not whether we transition to clean energy. We know we have to do these things to have the future that we all deserve. But the question is how we pay for them and who is going to be paying for them. And we need to make sure that the cost of the transition doesn't fall on people who did nothing to cause the problem. So we're really focused on making sure that fossil fuel companies are paying their share, that executives are paying their fair share. And the Biden administration had helped to do things like that with tax policy and then investing federal money. And we're really worried about seeing that go away.
So let's turn now to the ACLU's portfolio and, you know, what you're expecting from the Trump administration. Not, I mean, I want to say for the last half of the show what you're going to do about it, but, you know, where are you seeing the politicization of the DOJ and, you know, the other agency proposals that are coming through? How do you see those coming down on your portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a version of this which is really broad, and you know, there are concerns about the rule of law. There are concerns about our basic understanding of the structure of the Constitution as providing a floor, right? And states can move up from there. But there are a lot of reasons that, you know, our focus has been for over 100 years looking at civil rights and civil liberties issues. And I think some of the pieces that are likely to be contested are things that had not been on the table before. And so being ready for some of those arguments and for coming back to litigate over them, which is what happened in the first Trump administration in many instances, that's something that you're going to see a lot.
You're just one illustrative example so people can hook on to what you're saying.
So, you know, recently there were discussions about birthright citizenship coming. Oh, right. Mm-hmm. That's a great example of something that I think there would be a real, a clear response by ACLU on, and many other areas where there is a, you know, an effort to redefine or change the scope of pretty settled law. I do think that the primacy idea, this idea that the state Supreme Court can review cases and look at the way that the law works at the state level in a distinct way is likely to be something that we continue to work to pursue. So we've had a number of cases in Maine over the last 5 years that have focused on ways in which the Maine Constitution does provide additional support for different positions that we've taken. And it may become increasingly important for that work to continue.
So Jessica, coming back around now, I mean, this is, you know, a little bit of a question, as it probably always has been, you know, whose rights? You know, thinking about what Lucy was saying about the opening up of national monuments to private investors, I'm sure some people think freedom, private rights, you know, now I get to like exercise my rights more fully than I was able to do before. So I'm sure there are some people who look at these initiatives by the Trump administration as tremendously freeing. And as you were saying before, you know, it's a question of which entity is protecting whose rights from whom. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but can you try to untangle that thought and comment on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the vision that seems to be underlying Project 2025 and the federal government's capacity and bureaucracy is really, it's a vision of strong national borders, an idea of people being in or being out, attempt to try to limit regulation in the service of health and welfare and labor protections and the like, certainly environmental protections. So I think certainly there are you know, sort of xenophobic and racist and misogynistic elements of it. I think that cannot be denied. But also just with respect to the kinds of government powers and the kinds of government actors, I think they're much less favorable to regulation, to things that sound in sort of lawmaking approaches and much more focused on enforcement, on execution, on sort of carrying out certain kinds of mandates in that way. So I think, you know, there's always a lot of complications, and I think we'll see what happens with respect to actual attempts at regulation or deregulation, lawmaking or lack thereof. But that's, I think, how I would frame this sort of basic divide.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a level of cynicism, though, too, that runs through. I mean, I know, Jessica, you've done some work on this question of like what sounds like a good idea during one circumstance in terms of who is in power really can change quite quickly. And there isn't as much consistency here as I think we might have historically looked for ideologically. So there's also this sort of willingness to champion a certain idea and then really retreat from it if it's not expedient or if in a different circumstance there's another argument to be made. So that flexibility, I think, is also something that, again, in a constitutional law context, we would be coming back to really fundamental understandings of what rights mean in the United States for everybody. So to your point, Anne, there are circumstances where rights come into conflict, but there's also sort of a basic ground on which we've built something that allows people to engage and have freedom with the ability to, for example, vote or access public benefits or access public lands. This is going to be an interesting time where a lot of these ideas are contested in ways that they had not been. And looking within the context of Maine to Maine people, to Maine historical legislative purpose information, to really try to get back to a place where we can articulate values may become really important as we go forward.
Okay, I want to spend the last segment of the show right on that subject. So we'll do one more station break, and then I just want to talk about Maine and what Maine can do and is planning to do in this context. So you're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Anne Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Jessica Bullman-Posen, Betts Professor of Law at Columbia Law School, Molly Curran-Rowles, Executive Director of the ACLU of Maine, and Lucy Hochstartner, Climate and Clean Energy Director at Maine Conservation Voters. We're talking about states' rights then and now. This program was pre-recorded on January 14th. No listener calls are being taken. So there's been a lot of talk about, I hate to just put it in the vernacular, but blue states sort of banding together and passing protective laws to counteract what they see as hostile policy from the Trump administration. How is that landing? And just Jessica, give us the overview, and then I want to, you know, give Molly and Lucy a chance to say how it's landing in Maine.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we saw with the first Trump administration the idea of resistance in states as leaders of, or at least important participants in the resistance. I think that will remain a part of this second incoming Trump administration. The idea, one, that states have a particular ability to sue the federal government because of some earlier decisions by the United States Supreme Court. States can often get into court when other people can't. That's not always the case, but there's at least some basis for that. And so states may be able to sue, as they again did last time, with respect to Trump administration policies. They could also, as we were talking about earlier, refuse to cooperate, refuse to help carry out. I think that will be especially important with respect to immigration. It may become important with respect to abortion, depending on what the federal government does there. So there's sort of a swath of resistance that's about not cooperating or antagonizing the federal government. But I think there's also a really important piece of the agenda that Molly was just alluding to a moment ago, which is about states charting a new path themselves and trying to provide really responsive and good governance. And so if people are unhappy with what the federal government is doing, it's one thing to resist it, but it's also a harder, but I think also equally important, maybe more important thing to try to provide new laws, new regulations, new citizen initiatives to try to show how things should be done. And so, you know, in Maine, you have the Citizen Initiative. It's the popular initiative. It's the rare state in the Northeast to have it. So it's both representative government officials doing things, but also the people themselves having some real power to make changes. And I think that really shouldn't be overlooked.
Are you seeing coordinated strategies among the states for some of these things, Jessica?
I think there has certainly been sharing discussion. I mean, not that I would necessarily have the visibility into it, but between and among states at the level of governor's offices, certainly attorneys general, solicitors general. I think litigation strategy is often something that is coordinated. In the past, there's often been a lot of coordination just across the states. Generally, that has become a very partisan kind of divide in more recent years, where blue state AGs and red state AGs. But that's certainly an area of a lot of coordination. I think with respect to adopting policies, sort of adopting interstate agreements, compacts, those kinds of things, there's less of it. I mean, there's some successful examples from the recent past, like the REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. I don't know if Lucy wants to weigh in on that, but you know, there's sort of in certain domains efforts to actually band together. I think we see it with respect to shield laws and abortion policy, where states are not necessarily adopting a joint policy, but they're talking to each other, they're learning from each other, they're trying to build off each other's ideas. So at a minimum, I think we'll see that that kind of mutual exploration. I don't know how much actual joint policymaking we'll see.
All right. So let's talk about Maine in this context. And Molly, what are you seeing coming down the pike as far as ACLU Maine is concerned?
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to the question of collaboration and work across state lines. We also work, obviously, at the national level. And I think right now what we're seeing is a lot of politicization that makes it really, really difficult for folks to step out front, except for a few states that are really well known as being very blue and very comfortable in that resistance mode publicly. Maine is more of a purple dynamic in a lot of different ways, and a state that doesn't have as many resources locally and often relies on the federal government to make investments that help us move things forward in ways that we really need to. So I'm seeing a lot of reticence and concern for sure, but also as we've talked to a lot of folks in both elected officials and also people in different leadership roles, a little bit of hopefulness that this isn't going to be so bad, and that, you know, despite the clarity of Project 2025 and a number of statements by the incoming administration, that maybe things are being overblown and it won't actually be as big of a deal. So I think part of what we're working on is building plans so that we're ready to be responsive if and when things that are really egregious and unexpected and unprecedented happen or start to happen in certain areas. Certainly immigration is a great example of that. But again, I think there's still a lot of wait and see in a way that it has been somewhat surprising to us locally.
I know that you've been involved with the League of Women Voters in working on state voting rights acts. Just say a bit about that and how protective those might be when National Voting Rights Act is falling apart.
Right. Again, Maine is a place where this idea of primacy, of looking to the state constitution first and having the law court make their own interpretation, even in the instance where the language is the same between the Maine constitution and the national constitution, there is really good black letter law on this. So I think there's a lot of reason to continue to move forward with cases that explore how we could make this stronger and ensure that there are rights in Maine, regardless of what's happening in other parts of the country.
In addition to voting rights and immigration law, which other particular areas are on the radar for ACLU?
So right now we're doing a pretty large case involving the Sixth Amendment right to counsel by indigent folks. And that's a really important initiative. We also are waiting for a decision on a Fourth Amendment case that actually argues that the Maine Constitution's standards are higher in this particular area of criminal
law. People are not going to know what the Fourth Amendment is.
It's a case involving a wrongful arrest, and that we've argued that the standard on it, of the Maine Constitution, is higher than the Fourth Amendment standard. I think we will continue to be looking at reproductive rights and also at discrimination. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the challenges related to immigration law. There may not be as much that can be done if certain sweeping changes are made. There may be really significant big shifts in how immigration law is enforced in the United States. But we do have the ability to both work with local and state officials to try to limit the amount of Maine material and Maine human resources that are used for those initiatives. And we also really want to make sure that people understand that their basic rights in many instances are not changing. People have access to basic constitutional rights both here in Maine and under the Maine Human Rights Act, and also based on federal law. So we'll be doing a lot of outreach to people who are potentially impacted as well. We've already started doing a lot of that work in community. And I think, you know, that's going to continue to be a very important piece, getting accurate information out to people. There's a lot of misinformation that's already circulating, especially in vulnerable communities. And so being a part of ensuring that that people can make decisions that make sense for their families as the law is changing. It's going to be a really difficult thing. And the more that we can collaborate with League of Women Voters, with MCA and other partners, the more we'll be knitting together something that I think can really help support Mainers across the board.
And I mean, when you're talking about sanctuary cities, that's where you're saying you can't protect people in those cities from federal government incursion, but we can keep our own law enforcement from having to help.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things as attorneys, right, I'm getting a lot of questions about civil disobedience, and civil disobedience is outside the scope of the work that ACLU has done or the way that we've made change historically. As attorneys, we're going to need to make people aware of what the status of the law is, and we won't be able to advise people to break the law. Within that, yeah, we can certainly advocate for whatever is possible to pursue a humane and appropriate approach to law enforcement and to immigration in particular.
So I want to now turn to you, Lucy, and say what is on the horizon for the Maine Conservation Alliance in terms of laws to be passed in Maine or actions to be taken in Maine that you think will be protective over the next several years?
Yeah, this is such a great question and very topical. I'm in Augusta right now, and the Environmental Priorities Coalition, which MCA is the convener of, I believe 39 organizations now in Maine across the environmental movement, just released our priority slate of legislation today. So definitely on my mind and a lot coming up. For MCA, we are planning to work broadly in sort of five buckets. Your bread and butter environmental conservation, think clean air, clean land, clean water, and how that interacts with climate. So making sure we have adaptation measures and resilience measures that we are going to be ready for the effects that we're already facing. And a lot of that has to do with just making sure that the environment we have right now stays whole and intact. Those kinds of places, wild places, are much more resilient. So we're working with the EPC on some bills around Land for Maine's Future, which is, you know, the state's flagship conservation program, making sure that that's funded. We are working on some stormwater legislation, making sure that we have studies about how to best do that work. Stormwater has obviously become a huge issue in Maine with the increased storms that we're seeing. We do work in support of the Wabanaki Alliance on Wabanaki self-determination. And that's critical for both protecting the environment and really just making sure that everyone in Maine, regardless of whether they are Indigenous or not, have the full rights that they deserve. And that's really, unfortunately, in Maine's history, not been upheld for Wabanaki peoples. And so we do a fair amount of lobbying on that bill and follow the Wabanaki Alliance lead there. We're really building out some work on energy justice, which is sort of my bread and butter and I'm very excited about. We are thinking not only just how do we make energy in Maine, the energy we need to heat our homes and turn on the lights and refrigerate food, how do we make sure that's 100% clean and no fossil fuels, but how do we also make sure that everyone has it? So we are working on a big omnibus bill to protect Maine people from rising costs and to lower bills. So we are trying to both lower bills for everyone and also protect the most vulnerable populations from high bills when they do happen, getting rid of some really draconian shutoff practices that the utilities have. We're not going to be able to transition to clean energy and the kinds of technology we need if there are people who still can't pay their electric bill. And then we work with a lot of partners on this call on democracy work. So we're thinking about voting rights, the voter suppression ballot initiative, the attack on absentee voting. We're seeing that on the horizon this year and going to be doing everything we can to work against that. And then lastly, we do a fair amount of elections work. So you'll certainly see us just trying to make sure that with all of those priorities, we are electing people who are going to continue to advance them both this year and in years to come. So a lot on the horizon, but I think there's a lot that Maine can really do to advance this idea that, you know, we've talked about environmental and climate issues as these things that are separate from ourselves. And like, we need to protect this and keep it clean and just put it out there and not think about it. When really this affects our everyday life, and we need to be making sure that these things are working for all people in Maine, regardless of how much money they have to spend on electricity or a car or an electric vehicle. We need to really make sure that with this time that we have in the administration changeover, we use that to make things more equitable.
I want to give Molly and Jessica a minute to just sum up. I'm going to take what you just said as a sort of a summary. Lucy, Molly, go ahead. Take a minute to just give us some parting thoughts here.
Yeah, I think in so many areas, we're seeing what feels like an unprecedented level of threat against freedom of the press, against voting rights, against people's ability to really realize the promises of our Bill of Rights. And so the role that we anticipate playing is to continue to point back to those commitments and to hold government accountable and make sure that people have access to both the information that they need to navigate this time and also fundamental access to the courts to vindicate their rights wherever possible. We also have a lot of legislative work that we do in advocacy, and that will continue. Absolutely looking forward to being involved in the voting rights work that needs to happen here in Maine this year. But also building people's understanding of why these rights matter. And I think part of the politicization that's been the most problematic is that it's really difficult to come to any basic shared understanding. And part of why we see the erosion of public trust in our processes and in our leadership and in our law is that there isn't enough information out there that is shared. And so that's another area that we'll be doing a lot of work on as we do outreach this year. We're rebuilding a volunteer cohort as well. And so look forward to working with folks who are interested in any number of issues that we may touch upon, and working to do this work statewide. There's often a default to the southern part of the state, and so wanting to make sure that we're really reaching a lot of areas where folks are going to need our help.
Thanks, Molly.
Thanks.
Jessica, sum us up. States' rights now.
Yeah, well, I think states' rights are more important than ever now as the inauguration looms. I think there are reasons to be hopeful about the role states can play in the coming years that date back all the way to the founding, as we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation. If the idea is that we split power, we divide sovereignty between the states and the federal government to protect individual liberty, to protect people's rights, to protect either government from overreaching and encroaching on that liberty, then now is a really important time for states to show how they will engage in that resistance, whether it's by objecting to federal government policy, by filing lawsuits, by refusing to cooperate, but also I think by showing that they, as their own governments, can provide laws that serve their people. And through state constitutional rights development, I think there are a lot of opportunities in the coming years for state courts, for state people to articulate visions of American constitutional rights that are found in their state constitutions, American governance that are found in state laws, and to really chart a path forward that's beyond simply resisting what the federal government is doing.
Thank you so much. That's our show for today. It's been a great conversation. Our guests were Jessica Bowman-Posen, Betts Professor of Law at Columbia Law School, Molly Curran-Rawls, Executive Director at ACLU of Maine, and Lucy Hochschartner, Climate and Clean Energy Director at Maine Conservation Voters. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM, streaming at weru.org. If you have a comment about the show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in this series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you here next month.